Good morning, good morning, good morning, Sunday morning. I love seeing you. I love talking with you on Sunday mornings and talking about my favorite topics, including inflammatory bowel disease. It's a little too early for that. So first, it is the executive director that's right here, Jackie Atchicola, of the Every Cat Health Foundation. Wow, this sounds like a good organization. Tell me about the organization.
Well, it is a great organization, and you should also tout that because you're secretary of our board of Every Cat Health Foundation, formerly known as the Wynn Feline Foundation for over 50 years. But we are the world's only organization, a nonprofit foundation, that is solely focused on funding cat health research.
You know, what I often say, Jackie, is that if you have a cat, if you know a cat, if you've ever seen a cat, that cat every day is affected in a good way by research that this organization has funded over the past, 53, I think it is, years now.
Every Cat Health Foundation really does benefit every cat every day and everywhere. We fund cat health research throughout the world. And whether it's my cat or your cat or community cats, shelter cats, the research we fund helps all of those cats. And cats for so many years have been kind of the underserved domestic animal. And just to help them is such a joy, and we do that every day.
Indeed. You know, we could go through examples that would take up hours, literally a day or two or three. But one example is even what we feed cats. There wasn't enough of an amino acid called taurine in cat food for years and years. Cats were getting sick and dying of a kind of heart disease, and that's not the case anymore because years and years ago, what was then the Wynn Feline Foundation, now Every Cat Health Foundation, funded studies that said, yeah, that's true. There isn't enough of this amino acid called taurine in cat food. Now, every cat food manufacturer on the planet knows how much taurine cats need. Another example is FIP, or feline infectious peritonitis, once thought to be fatal.
Yes, thankfully, research that we fund and really is near and dear to a lot of cat owners is helping cats that would otherwise have kind of a death sentence if they got diagnosed with FIP. Now veterinarians are realizing and companies are getting behind, putting more forward movement into this study, and cats are surviving.
We're just right around the corner of Cures for Cats Day. Tell me about that.
Really, it's going to be a whole month leading up to Cures for Cats Day, which will happen and we'll celebrate mid-October. But each year, Every Cat Health Foundation highlights a specific disease, and we'll have webinars during the month. We'll promote information, and we'll be interactive with cat owners, cat researchers, cat veterinarians, all relating that something that you might talk a little bit about with a cat that
sure.
you once had
yes.
and the Ricky Fund.
So it's called Feline Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy. That sounds bad, doesn't it?
HCM. And we'll call it HCM.
HCM is easier, and it is bad for a whole lot of cats. It is arguably, we think, the number one cause of death in cats that are from about the age of past kittenhood until they reach 10, 11, or 12 when kidney disease and cancers begin to occur. And even then, it is sadly still very, very common. So something needs to be done. And this year, the Every Cat Health Foundation is saying we are going to do something about it. You mentioned the webinars. The nice thing about those webinars is they're very costly for people to attend. How much are they?
They're free.
I like that word. And you have some of the best experts on the planet, actually, talking to all of you if you'd like to watch. And yes, they are absolutely free. Now, to learn more about the schedule of those webinars, to learn more about Cures for Cats Day, and to learn more about the Every Cat Health Foundation, where can people go?
To everycat.org, our website. There's all kinds of information there. You can also follow us on Facebook, on Instagram. We are around. We'd love you to sign up for our e-newsletter as well so we can keep pushing information out to you. And we want to hear about your stories about cats and how cats are in your lives.
Perfect. Jackie Atchicola, Every Cat Health Foundation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve Dale.
I spoke about this on my Friday appearance with Anna DeVlantis right here on WGN. It's awful. 75 dogs
were killed in a fire at the Ponderosa Pet Resort in Georgetown, Texas, just about a week or so ago. The firefighters came, and by then, each and every dog had perished in the fire. Now, there were no people injured because nobody was there at the time of the fire. A makeshift memorial was created at the site, and the town, talk about empathetic, they've said, okay, we want a permanent memorial set up, which is wonderful. But what we need in every state in America is what we did here in Chicago. So in 2019, you may recall, 30 dogs were killed in a fire on January 14th at the Bully Life Animal Services, once called D&D Kennels in West Chicago. Now, allegedly, there were inhumane conditions and training standards. It was overcrowded, all this other stuff that I've talked about. But the fact is that no one wanted a fire to kill the dogs, overcrowded, appropriate training standards or not. I mean, those other issues are issues. But I'm just talking about the fire safety issue at the moment. Now, knowing how many kennel and doggy daycare fires happen, I created a fire safety bill. I did it with the help of Mark Ayers, Illinois Director of the Humane Society of the United States. We went to State Representative Diane Pappas, who made it happen in a nonpartisan way. And the governor signed the bill. And here's what the bill says. It mandates, and in Illinois now it's a law, and I hope other states like Texas now, and I've talked to the folks in Texas. They contacted me. The bill in Illinois mandates that facilities such as kennels and doggy daycare must have a fire alarm system ringing directly to first responders, a sprinkler system, or a staffing plan to demonstrate that a human is on the premises 24/7. All of that happened, and the only people that complained about it were some of the doggy daycare facilities and boarding facilities that said, this is not going to be affordable. But it turns out that if they pass on the cost to clients, clients will be paying, or are paying, an extra penny, maybe as much as a dime a night. Are you willing to pay that for your pets to be safe? Of course, an extra penny? Are you kidding? Or even an extra dime? You know, it's an extra, if your pet stays three nights, it's 30 cents, right? The law so far is working in Illinois. The hope is that they will follow suit in Texas. Sadly, it takes a tragedy all too often to make something good happen.
Dr. Jennifer Lopez is a professional services veterinarian at Antech who loves talking about, and I will tell you, friends, that only this radio show talks about this, and that is diarrhea in dogs. Inflammatory bowel disease is what we really want to talk about. What is IBD exactly? What's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. So IBD is kind of almost like the umbrella of what we call in veterinary medicine that chronic enteropathy. So obviously a lot of dogs are affected with IBD or diarrhea, chronic enteropathies, and so it really can vary when they come into the hospital and see us. So they could have maybe vomiting and diarrhea or a couple days of actual having GI symptoms. And so it's kind of left for us, the veterinarians, to kind of put everything together and get down to the cause of it, you know, because we obviously love our pets a lot. And sometimes we do give them, you know, maybe some treats every now and again, and they could have gotten into some of the garbage, or maybe we just had a barbecue. And so that could have been the cause of the GI upset.
So that's exactly what – so I've used the term garbage stomach before.
Yeah.
You know, the dog gets into the trash.
Yeah.
I like garbage gut a lot better. Yeah. Now I will use that.
We can also say diarrhea cha-cha-cha.
And that's what happens. It's a dog. How does the pet parent know, okay, that my dog's going to be okay, it's no big deal, my dog might have gotten into something, or on our walk outside, my dog might have chewed something up that maybe
that's
he or
right.
she shouldn't have done,
yeah.
but we'll be okay tomorrow. I mean, at what point does the pet parent know, oh no, I've got to see a veterinarian.
Yeah, and it's hard too because we know we have a lot of dogs and when we take them on a walk, they like to sample maybe some of the things that are out on the street.
Free sample.
Especially where I live in New York City, so there's lots of sampling to be done.
Yep.
But I think it's really nice to have a veterinarian to put together the whole picture. So if we have owners coming in, you know, the earlier the better they can get them in to see the vet, I think is the most important because then we can kind of piece together those puzzle pieces and really give them a little bit better of a diagnosis. Because when we come to IBD, it's more of a chronic thing. So if maybe we've had a dog that comes in for diarrhea maybe last week and then we see him again 2 months later, that could still be termed that chronic enteropathy, especially too when we have weight loss that is associated with that. Mm. So,
and most people don't weigh their dogs.
They don't.
At home, and that's obviously something you do. So why do dogs get this in the first place? Is there some breed specificity where certain breeds it happens in more often? Or is it the way the dog is raised? Is it the pet food? These are questions, really, that people ask all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot, too, comes to term with what exactly is going on in the breed, in the gut, obviously, too, some microbiome issues. So maybe I'm more sensitive to certain types of food than maybe you would. Maybe it has to do with Wheatons or Boxers or those delicious little Frenchies with their smushy faces. We find a lot of issues, too, with Irish Setters. But what we find is IBD is really common middle-aged to older dogs. And so it doesn't happen necessarily as much in young dogs, but it can. It just depends on kind of their gut microbiome. So is it dietary? Is it environmental? I think really the jury is still out. So we're trying to put pieces together.
How about emotional? So here's why I'm asking. You know, I mean, before you're at a veterinary conference. We're at the Western Veterinary Conference. Before the famous Dr. J-Lo takes the stage, maybe she's nervous, or maybe I'm nervous before I take the stage here.
Yeah.
And that nervousness in human beings sometimes goes to our gut. The same thing is true for dogs.
I hope you didn't hear my stomach gurgling. That's why you asked the question.
I would not do
I mean,
that.
It definitely could be. Absolutely. Maybe we have dogs that stay home a lot, and a lot of the people are going back to work, so that potentially could also be the case. And it has to do too with what are we feeding them? You know, what is that common diet? Are they getting chicken nuggets all the time? Are they getting, you know, steak kebabs? Who knows?
Yeah. So we describe what inflammatory bowel disease is, which is really common, correct?
It is common, and it's actually dogs are coming in to see us in the ER and also in general practice. I think number two is the reason for stomach issues, even when we see dogs in the ER and they've waited a little bit longer. So, yeah, it's a big, big deal.
I'm guessing it's incredibly common to be misdiagnosed, not by veterinarians so much as pet parents who are assuming fill in the blank. And then by the time they go to see the veterinarian, I'm not talking about wherever they go online, that might give them the misinformation, but by the time they go to see their veterinarians, it's been going on a while. Is that sometime happen?
It is, and it's really complex, and so there is a lot of detective work to put together. As the veterinarian, as the pet owner, sometimes we don't realize what's going on until it's almost too late. And then we said, oh, wait a second, didn't that dog come in 2 months ago and now it's back here for vomiting and diarrhea and now it's more severe. So we really need to get to the bottom of things and put together a good kind of, we call, minimum database and figure out, rule things in and rule things out, because there are lots of things that could potentially cause same signs and symptoms that irritable bowel, well, IBD we call it, little different than what we would say in human medicine, that chronic enteropathy.
So how do you determine? Is there a test for it?
There is a test. We actually have a blood test that is just, I believe, available for general practitioners. And what we recommend is absolutely to start with what we would find most commonly in dogs. So we want to make sure we're ruling out parasites. We want to make sure that we're getting the chemistry, the blood cell counts, the urinalysis, ruling out those common things. Maybe the dog ate rocks and we did x-rays.
Yeah,
and we ruled it out. Or if there was a toy or that pacifier that was missing from our newborn, we need to do those x-rays and figure out those are not the causes. And once we're able to put together a good plan, then I think that an IBD test is definitely feasible.
And And what kind of test is it? You said it's a blood test.
So it's a blood test. Simple blood test, very small amount of blood. And then we would send it out to our Antech laboratories. And what they would look at are three different biomarkers. So we're looking for what we call mucosal barrier, kind of disintegration, inflammation, and that integrity that maybe that biome is not working as well. So dysbiosis.
All right. So once discovered and once diagnosed, now what? What do you do?
Yeah. And so I think people are really maybe comfortable with this in human medicine because we've used a lot of serological biomarkers. So I don't want to say TMI about people having diarrhea, but many people have probably taken tests at their, you know, GI doctors,
sure,
similar to the ones we have for dogs. And so that's why we're really excited to have it available for dogs. And so we're going to be able to piece together, maybe start a good food trial, because I don't know if you know, but 60% of dogs actually can go into remission on these clinical signs with vomiting and diarrhea just with diet. So,
or telling the pet parents not to add the fatty chicken, you know, make sure certain things are not in their diet.
Absolutely.
That commonly pet parents just don't know not to give their dogs.
Right. And probiotics are so important.
I was just going to ask
fiber.
You about that.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. So there are a couple of probiotics on the market. Purina's Fortiflora is the most common.
Sure.
Are they helpful for these dogs?
Absolutely. I mean, there's tons of options out there, and I think if you work closely with your veterinarian, they'll recommend the most appropriate for you. But there's so many great things that we can add in addition. Also fiber, even if you think about that canned pumpkin or some of those Fiber One cereals, some of the little Metamucil scoops on their food is really going to help their gut just the same way it would help us.
Is it a good idea for these dogs with chronic on-again and off-again IBD to keep some of these things in the house, even, that are easy to get, the canned pumpkin, Metamucil?
Sure, absolutely. And I think probably with those dogs that are chronic, it would really benefit if they were on a specific diet. So a novel protein, maybe a hydrolyzed diet, those veterinary therapeutic diets are really more important than anything.
And the veterinarian can help you with that.
Of course.
How big of an enemy are extra treats for IBD, or is that irrelevant? And the other thing we talked about is emotion, is getting down to determine, okay, this dog also has thunderstorm anxiety. It seems that the IBD happens when there are thunderstorms.
Sure. Yeah. And there are lots of treats available, but I think also, too, kind of working with everything as a bigger picture with your veterinarian is the most ideal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if you say it's the most ideal, it's got to be the most
ideal. Go see your veterinarian.
Yes, Dr. Jennifer Lopez is one of those veterinarians from Antech. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So earlier in the show, I had an opportunity to talk to Jackie Atchicola, the executive director of the Every Cat Health Foundation, and am so excited because it's a big day. Yeah, I'm talking about Cures for Cats Day. October 17th. And every year leading up to that, last year the focus was kidney disease. The year before, I believe it was diabetes. This year it's heart disease. And that means a lot for my heart because I began a fund called the Ricky Fund, named as Jackie and I briefly spoke about, for a cat that I had who was on WGN radio a lot, was on national television, local television, because Ricky played the piano. This was 20 years ago. Cats didn't do, it was more than 20 years ago. They didn't do that kind of thing. Also, jump through hoops, if you happen to have a hula hoop, could, if you had little children and they laid down side by side, you jump over one child, another child, another child. When come would called, that's the most amazing thing of all, right? A cat, you call the cat's name and the cat actually comes to you. Well, Ricky ended up dying suddenly of this kind of heart disease, the most common heart disease in cats called feline hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. I mean, I was just stunned when he was diagnosed, but at least we knew he had it. We knew this was a possibility. Cats with HCM, or feline hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, are not necessarily going to die, but they're likely to. And it can happen any number of ways. Sudden death, like our cat Ricky, sometimes they throw a clot called the thromboembolism, and it happens over and over and over again. And each time they have to go to the emergency clinic, it gets more expensive, of course, every time. Every time's a little worse for the cat, usually. And this is really painful for cats. Or they go into heart failure, which there is no way out of, ultimately. So it's not good. And it's so common. It may be the number one cause of death, period, for any cat between the age of about 2 to 3 years of age to the age of about 10. So set up this fund called the Ricky Fund. I talked about Ricky. We show some video clips of Ricky playing the piano and doing other things on television. In addition to that, more on heart disease. That's all on my website. It's a webinar I gave for the Every Cat Health Foundation. And you can go to stevedale.tv and you can watch it right there. Watching this webinar, by the way, is absolutely free. stevedale.tv. Next week, with the holidays, or should I say howlidays around the corner, some tips about taking pictures of your pets. And we'll also talk about blah, 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 Halloween, which is also around the corner. That's next week, bright and early, right here, Steve Dale's Pet World on 720 WGN.